coalition efforts by treasure hunters. It's this imagery, on the far side of the world, including that stone serpent in the Temple of the Moon, that a year later will suddenly come to mind in Sanliurfa Museum as I study the collection of reliefs from Göbekli Tepe. The obvious parallels include the following. At Göbekli Tepe, there's a creature sculpted in high relief, identified by Klaus Schmidt as a beast of prey with splayed claws and powerful shoulders, its tail bent to its left over its body. A very similar animal is seen at Kutimbo, with the same splayed claws and the same powerful shoulders, while the tail, instead of being bent to its left, is bent to its right. At both Göbekli Tepe and Kutimbo, reliefs of salamanders and of serpents are found. The style of execution, in all cases, is very similar. At about the level of the genitals of the so-called totem pole of Göbekli Tepe, a small head and two arms protrude. The head has a determined look, with prominent brows. The long fingers of the hands almost meet. The posture is that of a man leaning down through the stone and playing a drum. This is also the posture of two figures at Kutimbo, who emerge from a large convex block on one of the circular towers. They have the same determined features and prominent brow ridges as the figure on the totem pole. The two serpents, on the side of the totem pole, have peculiarly large heads, making them look almost like sperm. So too does the serpent that emerges from the dark, narrow entrance of the Temple of the Moon above Cusco. Lions feature in the reliefs at Göbekli Tepe, pumas feature in the reliefs at Kutimbo, and again, the manner of representation is similar. I don't know what to make of these similarities. Just coincidences? Very likely. Even so, they go on. City of Viracocha. It's quite a trial, crossing the land border from Peru into Bolivia through a series of bureaucratic hurdles and long queues. But close by is the charmingly named town of Copacabana and a comfortable hotel overlooking Lake Titicaca. If we had more time, we'd visit the islands of the Sun and the Moon by boat from here. But we've been to them often before, and they're not our target on this trip. It's Tiwanaku, up on the Altiplano at 12,800 feet, near the southeastern shore of the giant lake, that we're keen to get back to. Orthodox archaeologists date Tiwanaku to the period between 1580 BC and AD 724. But in both Fingerprints of the Gods and Heaven's Mirror, I argued that it might ultimately prove to be many thousands of years older than that. Up to now, less than 2% of the site has been excavated, and I think it likely that further excavations will force a change of the archaeological paradigm. It is perhaps a sign of things to come that on the 27th of March 2015, Bolivia's Tiwanaku Archaeological Research Center reported that a survey with ground-penetrating radar had revealed the existence of a complete buried pyramid in a previously unexcavated area of the site, together with a number of underground anomalies that are thought to be monoliths. A 5-year plan of excavation to learn more about these mysterious structures has now been launched. Since I've already described Tiwanaku at length in my previous books, it seems superfluous to repeat those descriptions here. What's new for me on my October 2013 visit is a much closer look at the machine-age precision of the megaliths littered around the immense platform of the Pumapunku and the truly intricate manner in which so much of the stone has been cut, molded, I think Jesus Gamara would say. As at the Coricancha, I come across several megaliths that resemble circuit boards stripped of their circuits. There are others with cross-shaped indentations that look as though they were part of some contraption, as though perhaps they were to receive the ends of metal axles or connecting pieces that have long since oxidized or been carried off by looters. Particularly striking, because I've missed them before on all previous visits, are a couple of rows of massive andesite blocks, all identical as though stamped out of some mold, and all shaped like the letter H. The comparison with the H motif at Göbekli Tepe on the belts of the pillars, for example, is irresistible, even if it is just another coincidence. Then there's the pillar statue in the semi-subterranean temple at Tiwanaku. Like the totem pole of Göbekli Tepe, it is anthropomorphic. Like the totem pole at Göbekli Tepe, it has serpents writhing up its side. Like the totem pole at Göbekli Tepe, the long fingers of its hands almost meet in front of its body. The face is human, not animal. However, it's heavily bearded. Nonetheless, the figure of an animal is carved on the side of its head, and this animal resembles no known species more closely than it does Toxodon, a sort of New World rhino that went extinct during the cataclysms at the end of the Ice Age, around 12,000 years ago. This isn't pareidolia. The figure is definitely there, so there's only one question, and it's difficult to answer. Is this a depiction of Toxodon, or is it some creature of the artist's imagination? I move on into the Colossacea, the huge open rectangle bounded by megalithic walls that appears to have been the central ceremonial area of ancient Tiwanaku. On the monolithic gateway of the sun is carved the image of another elephant with tusks and trunk, like the elephant sculpted into the living bedrock of the Temple of the Moon near Sacsayhuaman. This Tiwanaku elephant has been dismissed by critics as merely the heads of two condors side by side. But if that is the case, then the image on the matching, mirror side of the gateway is puzzling, since it definitely shows two condors side by side, yet is different from the elephant relief. If it was modelled from nature, it doesn't have to be that old. Cuvieronius, as noted earlier, survived in South America until 6,000 years ago. On the other hand, most related mastodon species went extinct during the Younger Dryas, between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. The Colossacea is a huge, largely empty open space, but there are two statues here that I want to take another look at. The Ponche monolith, named after Carlos Ponche Sanguines, the godfather of Bolivian archaeology, and El Frail, the friar, a smaller, slightly different version, done in the same general style. What's striking about both of them are the hand positions, with the fingers meeting across the belly, virtually identical to the hand positions on the Göbekli Tepe pillars or on the totem pole. However, the Tiwanaku figures, like the Mesopotamian Apkalus, carry objects in their hands, not a cone and a bucket, but as archaeologist and ethnobotanist Constantino Manuel Torres has demonstrated, snuff trays for the consumption of hallucinogenic DMT powders from the Amazon. It's a reminder, even up here in the cold, austere highlands of the Altiplano, that the Amazon, with its riotous, exuberant life, is not far away. When we are looking for the remnants of a lost civilization that once perhaps spanned the globe, it might not be the first place we would think of, but its dense jungles hide so much, and recent clearances have revealed the remains of ancient cities, megaliths, gigantic earthworks, and soils enriched by some mysterious process that keeps them fertile for thousands of years. What is also clear is that a legacy of high-level scientific skills, inherited from somewhere, was passed down through generation after generation of shamans. The making of a psychedelic DMT-containing brew, ayahuasca, from two jungle plants, neither of which is an orally active psychedelic in its own right, is an astonishing pharmacological achievement when we remember that there are 150,000 different species of plants and trees in the Amazon. Likewise, a nerve poison like curare, which has 11 different ingredients and which produces lethal fumes during preparation, is not something that can be dreamed up overnight, but requires the application of a thoroughly worked-out science. Another point of interest about the Tiwanaku monoliths is that their garments, from the waist down, are patterned in the form of fish scales. Here too is a parallel to the Apkalus, the bearded, fish-garbed figures who brought high civilization to Mesopotamia and whose mysteries we explored in earlier chapters. Nor is it as though bearded figures are missing from the repertoire of Tiwanaku. Two have survived, and one on the pillar in the semi-subterranean temple has been identified since time immemorial with the great civilizing deity Kon-Tiki Viracocha, who I wrote about at length in my previous books, and who is described in multiple myths and traditions as being white-skinned and bearded. Garcilaso Inca de la Vega, who lived through the last years of the conquest and grew up in Cuzco, wrote that Viracocha wore a thick beard, whereas the Indians are clean-shaven. And his robe came down to the ground, while that of the Incas came only to their knees. This is why the Peruvian people called the Spanish Viracochas the minute they saw them. The Indians had no difficulty believing that the Spaniards were all the sons of God. In other words, with their white skins and beards, the Spanish fitted an ancient tribal memory, passed down from generation to generation, of civilizing heroes who had come to the Andes in remote prehistory and taught the people there the skills of agriculture, architecture, and engineering. And what about Contiki Viracocha himself? What happened to him? It seems, after a civilizing mission across the Americas, his travels took him to Manta in Ecuador, from where he crossed the Pacific Ocean, walking on the water. I am not going to repeat here the stories and traditions of Viracocha that I reported in my previous books, but he is the Osiris and the Quetzalcoatl of the Andes, who comes in a time of darkness, after a great flood, bringing the gifts of civilization. That he should leave eventually, and that he should do so by some high-tech means, walking on the water across the Pacific Ocean, is intriguing. Let's follow him and see where he might have gone. Chapter 18. According to the most ancient traditions of Mesopotamia, humanity was created at the navel of the earth, in Uzu, flesh, sar, bond, ki, place or earth. In the Rig Veda, the most ancient scripture of India, the universe was born and developed from a core, a central point, bearing markings that Jesus Gamara would instantly nominate as belonging to the oldest Hanan Pacha style of the Andes, the Shetiya, foundation stone of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, now the rock of the Dome of the Rock, is considered to be the center of the earth. Indeed, this notion that there are certain primordial centers of creation from which all else grows is a global theme of ancient religion and mythology. The Most Holy One created the world like an embryo. As the embryo grows from the navel, so God began to create the world by the navel, and from there it spread out in all directions. In the Greek myth of the universal deluge sent by Zeus to punish mankind for wickedness, the only survivors are Deucalion and Pyrrha. Their ark comes to rest on Mount Parnassus, high above Delphi, a site regarded throughout classical antiquity as the navel of the earth. Just as Heliopolis in Egypt possessed the sacred Benben, a Betel stone fallen from heaven, so too Delphi possessed a Betel, nominated as its Omphalos or navel stone. It was specifically identified in Greek mythology as the stone which had been fed to the monstrous time god Cronos, who devoured his own children, in place of the infant Zeus. When Zeus grew to manhood, he took revenge on Cronos, driving him from the sky to the very depths of the universe, after first, in imagery that calls to mind the debris stream of a comet, forcing him to vomit up the stone. It landed in the exact center of the world, in the shrine at Delphi. We saw in the last chapter that the name Cuzco, the megalithic city in the Peruvian Andes, means the navel of the earth. More than 4,000 kilometers, 2,500 miles to the southwest, across the Pacific Ocean, the ancient name of Easter Island, Te Pito o Te Henua, also means the navel of the earth, which in turn has affinities to the ancient name of Tiwanaku, Tai Picala, the stone at the center. Indeed, on the edge of Easter Island's La Perouse Bay, there is a mysterious, spherical, carefully tooled stone called Te Pito Kura, the golden navel stone, which is regarded as the navel of the island itself. Traditions state that there was once a time when great magicians used this stone to focus their mana power, literally sorcery, to make the Moai, the famous megalithic statues of the island, walk from the quarry to the places where they were to be set up. An almost identical notion is preserved amongst the indigenous Aymara of Bolivia, who have lived in the vicinity of Tiwanaku since time immemorial. They state that the mysterious city with its own extraordinary megalithic statues was built by magic in a single night, and that the stones came down of their own accord, or at the sound of a trumpet from the mountain quarries, and took up their proper positions at the site. Nor do the parallels stop there. Since the late 1940s, when Thor Heyerdahl undertook his Kon-Tiki expedition, named after Kon-Tiki Viracocha, the civilizing deity of Tiwanaku, whom we met at the end of the last chapter, it has been noticed that there are similarities between the statues of Tiwanaku and the Moai of Easter Island. For example, as we've seen, the figures of Viracocha at Tiwanaku display prominent and pronounced beards, a sharp contrast to the indigenous inhabitants of the Andes who are not able to grow strong beards. And there is no doubt that the prominent chins of the Easter Island figures are also meant to represent beards. As Heyerdahl commented, "The statues on Easter Island had their chins carved, pointed and projecting, because the sculptors themselves grew beards." The Norwegian adventurer was likewise struck by the way that the Easter Island figures and the Tiwanaku figures have their hands laid in position on their stomachs. Both also wear distinctive broad belts. "The sole decoration of the Easter Island figures," he wrote, "is a belt, which was always carved round the figure's stomach. The same symbolic belt is to be found on every single statue in Kon-Tiki's ancient ruins by Lake Titicaca." Heyerdahl, who I had the privilege to know, and who was a strong supporter of the lost civilization hypothesis, did not have the opportunity to visit Göbekli Tepe before he passed away in 2002. Had he done so, however, I think he would have been struck by the resemblance between the hand positions depicted on the totem pole figure from Göbekli Tepe and the hand positions on the Viracocha pillar statue and on the Ponche and El Fraile monoliths at Tiwanaku. I pointed these resemblances out in the last chapter, but there's more. For example, the larger anthropomorphic pillars at Göbekli Tepe feature thick, sculpted belts, very similar to those seen on the Tiwanaku and Easter Island figures. Also noteworthy are the hand positions seen on the larger Göbekli Tepe pillars, with long fingers placed forward and almost meeting across the belly. Identical hand positions are seen on the Easter Island Moai. Last but not least, just as Easter Island, Tiwanaku, and Cuzco share the odd concept of being navels of the earth, so too does Göbekli Tepe, whether expressed in Turkish or in the Armenian language as Portisar, its very name means the hill of the navel. If all these are coincidences, then their profusion is rather extraordinary. Unless, of course, the same magicians of the gods who created and then buried the Göbekli Tepe time capsule at the end of the Younger Dryas some 11,600 years ago were also at work in Easter Island. Unless, in other words, the Moai of Easter Island are older, much older, than archaeologists think they are. A remnant of antediluvian lands? Archaeologists believe that the oldest of the Easter Island Moai was made around AD 690, and the youngest about 1,000 years later in AD 1650. This chronology is based on radiocarbon dating, which also puts the earliest human settlement on the island at AD 318. As we have seen, however, radiocarbon cannot date stone monuments directly. Inferences have to be made about the relationship between the organic materials that have been dated and the stone, and sometimes these inferences can be extremely misleading. For example, it would be a mistake to conclude that the Ahu platform at Ahu Nau Nau on Anakena Bay is the same age as the seven Moai mounted on it. The platform is obviously the work of a later culture that must have re-erected the statues because incorporated in the masonry of the platform itself, an ancient and heavily weathered Moai head has been reused as a construction block. Likewise, if, for example, human beings had settled here during the Younger Dryas, when sea level was much lower than it is today, and Easter Island was part of a chain of steep and narrow antediluvian islands as long as the Andes mountain range, then how much in the way of organic materials would they have left for archaeologists to carbon date? Perhaps the peak of the East Pacific Rise that we now know as Easter Island was not used for residential purposes at all, but kept exclusively for religious ceremonies in which the great monolithic statues played a part. Perhaps people came from other parts of the archipelago to attend those ceremonies and then return to their home islands, islands that are all now underwater. This is conjecture, of course, pure speculation, but it is temptingly suggested by a legend of the Easter Islanders themselves concerning a supernatural being called Uoke, who in remote times travelled around the Pacific with a gigantic lever with which he pried up whole islands and tossed them into the sea, where they vanished forever under the waves. After thus destroying many islands, he came at length to the coast of Te Pito o Te Henua, then a much larger land than it is today. He began to lever up parts of it and cast them into the sea. Eventually he reached a place called Puko Pihipui in the vicinity of Hangahunu, La Perouse Bay, site of the Golden Navel Stone. Here the rocks of the island were too sturdy for Uoke's lever, and it was broken against them. He was unable to dispose of the last fragment, and this remained as the island we know today. Thus, Te Pito o Te Henua continues to exist only through the accident of Uoke's broken lever. Legends also speak of a primeval Pacific homeland called Hiva, from which the first inhabitants of Easter Island came, a homeland that also fell victim to the mischief of Uoke's lever and was submerged under the sea. What is particularly striking about all this, because of its resonance with the seven sages, the Apkalu, spoken of in Mesopotamian antediluvian traditions, and with the seven sages of the Edfu building texts, who sought out new lands in which to recreate the drowned and devastated world of the gods, is that seven sages, kings, sons, all initiated men, are also said to have been instrumental in the original settlement of Easter Island. Exactly as was the case with the Apkalu, who laid the foundations of all future temples of Mesopotamia, and with the Edfu sages, who travelled the length and breadth of Egypt, establishing the sacred mounds on which all future pyramids and temples were to be built, the first task of the seven sages from Hiva, after their arrival on Easter Island, was the construction of stone mounds. Could there be anything to this? Is it possible that the Moai statues of Easter Island are the work of the survivors of a lost civilization, dating back to the Ice Age, 12,000 or more years ago? One possible hint comes from a discovery made by Dr. Robert J. Menzies, Director of Ocean Research at the Duke University Marine Laboratory, Beaufort, North Carolina. In 1966, Menzies led a 6-week oceanographic investigation of the Pacific off the coast of Peru and Ecuador in the waters of the Milne-Edwards Deep, a trench that drops off in places to almost 19,000 feet, 5,791 meters. Dr. Menzies' research vessel, the Anton Brun, deployed underwater cameras that were state-of-the-art at the time, and about 55 miles west of Callao, the port of Lima, capital of Peru, at a depth of 6,000 feet, in an area prone to marine subsidence, strange carved rock columns were photographed on the seabed. Two upright columns, about 2 feet or more in diameter, were sighted extending 5 feet out of the mud. Two more had fallen down and were partially buried, and another angular, squarish block was seen. "We did not find structures like these anywhere else," commented Dr. Menzies in an interview with Science News. "I have never seen anything like this before." The later official report of the crews of the research vessel added that one of the columns bore markings that appeared to be inscriptions. So far as I've been able to establish, Dr. Menzies' discovery, which hints at a real basis to the submerged land of Hiva, was never followed up. Meanwhile, what of Easter Island itself, where the survivors are said to have settled in order to reconstitute their lost world? The science of geology has some clues for us to consider. What lies beneath? Professor Robert Schock of Boston University, renowned for his geological redating of the Great Sphinx of Giza, does not easily or quickly bestow greater antiquity on monuments than is allowed by mainstream archaeology. Most often he goes with the orthodox chronology, but when he diverges, as he has with the Great Sphinx and with Gunung Padang in Indonesia, it is only because he has first been persuaded by strong geological evidence that archaeology has overlooked. This is the case with his analysis of the Moai statues of Easter Island. Here's his considered opinion after a research visit. I was particularly impressed, says Schock, by the varying degrees of weathering and erosion seen on the different moai, which could be telltale signs of major discrepancies in their ages. The levels of sedimentation around certain moai also impressed me. Some moai have been buried in up to an estimated 6 meters of sediment or more, such that even though they are standing erect, only their chins and heads are above the current ground level. Such high levels of sedimentation could occur quickly, for instance if there were catastrophic landslides, mud flows, or possibly tsunamis washing over the island. But I could not find any such evidence, and landslides or tsunamis would tend to shift and knock over the tall statues. Rather, to my eye, the sedimentation around certain moai suggests a much more extreme antiquity than most conventional archaeologists and historians believe to be the case or believe to be possible. Schock adds that he has begun to collect evidence on typical weathering, erosion and sedimentation rates on Easter Island during the modern period since records began to be kept. So far, it seems that sedimentation over the past century has been, on the whole, relatively modest. As usual, Schock understates his case, which is best illustrated at Ranuraruku Crater, an extinct volcanic caldera that served as the principal quarry from which the Easter Island moai were extracted. The inner slopes of the caldera, leading down to a small, reed-fringed lake, are lined with an estimated 270 statues in various stages of completion. Some lie on their backs or sides, many are perfectly upright, others jut at various crazy angles out of the ground, and the overall impression is one of some extraordinary surrealist show, interrupted in mid-preparation and abandoned forever by the artist. What it was all about, what it was all for, no one can honestly say, though there are many theories. Nonetheless, the setting is unmistakably geological, and the statues are themselves first and foremost geological artifacts, separated from the natural bedrock, yet still sufficiently in place to have remained part of their original setting. Mostly what you see, as you wander in bemused wonderment amongst them, are their serene, contemplative, bearded faces, their long-eared heads, their shoulders, and parts of their upper torsos. You could be forgiven for imagining that this is all there is to them, that they are just set a meter or so into the ground, sufficient to anchor them, and no more. But Thor Heyerdahl, that indefatigable adventurer and explorer, proved this was not the case when he excavated a number of the Ranuraruku Moai in 1956 and again in 1987, discovering that, like icebergs, the larger part of their mass lies beneath the surface. Photographs from those excavations show statues that go down more than 9 meters, 30 feet beneath the ground, into a deep, thick sediment of yellow clay. Studying these images, it becomes immediately apparent that Schock's argument has merit and that there is no way, in just a few hundred years. As noted earlier, archaeologists maintain that production of the moai stopped as recently as 1650, that such a massive amount of sedimentation could have accumulated. That would be the case even if Easter Island were part of a large, continuous landmass where there was potential for wind and water to transport soils from one area and deposit them in another. But Easter Island as we know it today, though an enigma of giant proportions, is just a tiny dot on the map in the midst of the world's largest and deepest ocean. Not only is it situated more than 2,000 miles from the coast of South America, but it is also more than 2,000 miles from Tahiti, the next substantial group of islands. With a total land area of just 63.2 square miles, 163.6 square kilometers, it is therefore all the more inconceivable that Easter Island itself could have contributed the 30-foot-deep sediment load seen around the moai in Ranuraruku Crater. Such a volume of sedimentation might, however, have been possible more than 12,000 years ago, when sea level was lower and, as we've seen, Easter Island was part of an extensive archipelago. Here, too, could be the answer to another mystery identified by Schock, which is the existence of a small number of moai carved from basalt. The problem is that there are no deposits of basalt on Easter Island itself. Schock speculates that the lost basalt quarries might be under sea level now because they are of extreme antiquity, and thus the basalt moai, carved from them, are extremely ancient. Sea levels, Schock points out, have risen dramatically since the end of the last ice age, some 10,000 or more years ago, and if the basalt moai were quarried along the coast of Easter Island from areas since inundated by the sea, this could help to date the basalt moai, and is immediately suggestive that they are thousands of years older than conventionally believed to be the case. The same solution, that Easter Island was once part of a much larger landmass, would also explain another very different puzzle, namely the so-called Rongo-Rongo script. It is unprecedented in human history for a sophisticated, fully developed writing system to be invented and put into use by a small, isolated island community. Yet Easter Island does have its own script, examples of which, mostly incised on wooden boards, copies of copies of copies of much older lost originals, were collected in the 19th century and have found their way into a number of museums around the world. None remain on Easter Island itself, and even in the period when they were collected, no native Easter Islanders were able to read them. To this day, the script remains undeciphered, yet another of the many enigmas of this island of mystery. The Sage of Badavali. It's the 28th of May, 2014, and I'm thousands of miles from Easter Island in the middle of the Badavali of central Sulawesi in Indonesia, standing in front of a huge moai-like figure carved from solid basalt and deeply embedded in a grassy field. What's striking about the statue, apart from its sheer size, the visible part, which slopes steeply over to its left, extends more than 4 meters, 13 feet out of the ground, is the posture of its arms and hands. These are arranged in exactly the manner of the Easter Island Moai, and also of the Göbekli Tepe figures, with the arms crooked at the side and the hands brought together across the front of the belly, with the fingers almost meeting. The big difference is that this figure, known locally as Watu Palindo, the wise man, shows off an erect penis and a pair of testicles between those extended fingers. How old is the wise man? Nobody knows, admits Iksam Kaili, curator of the Province Museum of Central Sulawesi, who has kindly accompanied me on this sector of a long research journey through Indonesia. Archaeology is in its infancy on our island. Kylie himself is inclined to the view that the statue, and a dozen others like it here in Badavali, are at least 4,000 years old. Other estimates vary between 5,000 years and less than 1,000 years, but none are of the slightest value, since no definitive archaeological dating has been done or can be done. The intrusion of organic materials from the different cultures that have lived and farmed this valley for millennia, several of which have at different periods dug up Watu Palindo looking for treasure, mean that we will never get to the truth. Artifacts from the not-too-far-distant Bisoa Valley have been carbon dated to 2,890 years ago, but so what? This tells us nothing at all about the age of the wise man. Getting to Badavali is quite a trek. Santha and I are travelling with Danny Hillman Natwijaja, the geologist who has brought the mysterious pyramid of Gunung Padang in West Java to the attention of the world. Also accompanying us is Danny's friend and colleague Vishnu Aryastaka, who has kindly looked after the logistics of our journey. We start off in Jakarta on the 26th of May and fly to Palu, the capital of the province of Central Sulawesi, where Iksam Kaili joins us on the morning of the 27th of May. Then we drive all day on an awesomely bad road through spectacular mountain country, reaching the town of Tentana on giant Lake Poso the same evening. The following day, 28th of May, we drive an additional 50 kilometers to the village of Bomba in the heart of the Badavali, which, like so much of Indonesia, is stunningly beautiful. A broad, flat plateau surrounded by green mountains plumed by silver clouds that reflect magically off gleaming rice fields. Reaching Bomba by mid-morning, we check into a basic but comfortable guest house and go straight out megalith hunting. There are, essentially, two kinds of megaliths in the valley, one being very large stone cisterns called kalamba, precisely cut and hollowed out within, and in some cases weighing more than a ton, the other being figures like Watu Palindo, weighing up to 20 tons. For 2 days we tramp along the borders of waterlogged rice fields and on rough tracks through forests. At one point we come to a statue lying on its back in the midst of a clearing, staring up at the heavens. A little later we find another, also on its back, lying in the midst of a river. Both show the same hand and arm positions as Watu Palindo, the sage. A third figure, with weird, fish-like features, is buried up to its neck in deep water rice. A fourth figure stands lonely on a ridge, gazing at a distant range of mountains. The frustrating thing is that nothing, really nothing at all, is known about these megaliths. Who created them? When? Why? All is mystery. Hobbits, Dragons, and the Flood. From the Bada Valley, we make a long road journey to Toraja in South Sulawesi. All journeys are long here. Sulawesi is the 11th largest island in the world. We spend a couple of days in the area. There is an eerie cult of the dead, which involves digging up the bodies of the deceased once a year, dressing them in new clothes, combing their mouldering hair, tidying their coffins, and reinterring them. Lifelike effigies of the deceased are also placed in rock-cut shrines high up in cliff faces, and there are caves full of bones. What we've come here to see are not the dead, but megaliths. This being Toraja, however, the megaliths are all about the dead, and unlike in other parts of the world, and indeed other parts of Indonesia, they aren't relics of a remote and forgotten past, but part of a living, active, fully functional cult. We visit Bori Parinding, a site dominated by a cluster of tall, needle-like menhirs that might be transplanted without difficulty to any one of a dozen locations in Europe and confidently dated to 5,000 years old or more. Yet Bori Parinding is just 200 years old. The oldest megalith here was erected in 1817. Each one is a monument to a deceased Torajan notable, and new menhirs are still quarried and put in place every year. Those cut from andesite are mined from a nearby deposit and shaped with hammers and metal chisels. A local elder shows me how it's done. Those cut from limestone, weighing in some cases an estimated 15 tons, are brought from a quarry 5 kilometers away by teams of hundreds of men working in shifts for more than a week who haul the menhirs to the site on wooden rollers. Indonesia, I'm beginning to realize, is a land where ancient traditions live on in fascinating ways, and the connection to the remote past is ever-present. That's a realization that's brought home to me all the more strongly on our next stop, the island of Flores. We reach it by driving all day from Toraja to Makassar, where we catch a flight to Bali, and thence via Komodo, famous for its large predatory lizards known as Komodo dragons, to Ende, the chief city of Flores, a city with a population of just 60,000. In recent times, Flores has attracted fame for the discovery on the island of the remains of Homo floresiensis, an extinct species of human that stood, in adulthood, just 1.1 meters, 3.5 feet tall, and has accordingly been dubbed the Hobbit. I'll have more to say about these creatures later, but as I land at Ende after that stopover in Komodo, I can't help reflecting that Indonesia is truly a mythical place, the only country in the world today where dragons and hobbits are not the stuff of fantasy, but of science. Flores is charming, far out on the edge of the world, simple, lacking in many modern conveniences, but with a sweet, gentle spirit. We base ourselves in the town of Bajawa, and in the couple of days we spend here, we visit a number of villages where the tidy bamboo and thatch houses are built upon and around extensive megalithic monuments. In the village of Bena, about 16 kilometers from Bajawa, with distant glimpses of the Savu Sea and of Mount Inari, we're shown around by Joseph, a venerable elder of 88 years. The village has 2 parallel rows of houses, with the high, thatched roofs, triangular in cross-section, that are characteristic of the area. The houses are separated by a long and wide public space, filled with an incredible assortment of menhirs and dolmens, which, as with the menhirs of Taraja, would not look out of place if they were excavated from Neolithic strata in Europe. Joseph tells us that the dolmens aren't tombs, as is usually the case in Europe, but altars used by members of each of the different clans resident in the village. From time to time, buffalo sacrifices are carried out on the altars in honor of deceased notables, and the megaliths have a function in aiding communication with the departed and in connecting the supernatural and earthly realms. Such ideas don't syncretize well with Christianity, which is also a part of daily life here. Indeed, at the far end of the village, there is a shrine to the Virgin Mary. Joseph tells us that dolmens and menhirs were still being erected when he was a young man, but that this is no longer done and the tradition is dying out. When I ask him about the origins of the megalithic cult, however, he tells me a remarkable story. Our ancestors, he says, came here in a ship around 12,000 years ago during a great flood. Indeed, it seems that the whole village is laid out in commemoration of that ship, which was propelled not by sails, but by an engine. Joseph shows me a megalithic chamber, roughly in the middle of the village, that symbolizes the place where the engine house was located in the original ship. I ask him where all the megaliths come from, and he tells me that they were brought from 20 kilometers away on the slopes of Mount Inari, and moved into position by special powers possessed by the ancestors. He adds that an American scholar, a certain Professor Smith, has confirmed the story. This mention of the name of a foreign researcher, whose identity and bona fides I was not subsequently able to establish, raises the nagging possibility in my mind that the whole tale might not be of indigenous origin at all, but might be an imported concoction, a fantasy even, which Joseph believes to be true. Certainly we are not told the same story in other megalithic villages of Flores. At Wagobaro, for example, elders spoke of a giant called Dake, who was so huge that he had single-handedly carried the megaliths down from the slopes of Mount Inari. What all the accounts seem to have in common, however, is a whiff of wonder and magic. Queen of the Southern Ocean. Leaving Flores, we fly from Ende via Denpasar in Bali to the city of Palembang in Sumatra, then make a two-day road journey from east to west across South Sumatra. Again, our focus is megaliths, but most of what we see in the form of large sculpted human and anthropomorphic figures shows the influence of Hindu and Buddhist art, and thus is certainly not prehistoric. It's only when we come to a coffee plantation in the mountains near the city of Pagaralam that we find something really interesting, a series of gigantic megalithic subterranean chambers, several of which are painted with swirling designs in striking colors of red ochre and black charcoal, amidst which animal figures can be discerned. No dating work has been done on them, but similar chambers such as West Kennet Longbarrow in England or Gavrinus in Carnac, Brittany, are more than 5,000 years old, while the painted caves of France and Spain are even older, going back 33,000 years in the case of Chauvet, for example. The Sumatran paintings have much in common with those of southern Europe, being profoundly visionary, with characteristic entoptic patterns indicating that the artists were shamans who had experienced and were depicting visions seen in deeply altered states of consciousness, likely induced by psychedelic plants or fungi. We drive on to the city of Bengkulu and fly from there to Jakarta, the massive, sprawling Indonesian capital on the island of Java. Jakarta is like a giant octopus. Once it has entangled you in the tentacles of its clogged roadways, it is extremely difficult to get free. Late the same evening, however, we eventually reach our next destination, Pelabuhan Ratu, on the southwest coast of Java, facing the Indian Ocean. It's only an overnight stop. In the morning, we'll be going to another megalithic site inland. But it turns out that Pelabuhan Ratu, which means Harbour of the Queen, is of interest in its own right. Indeed, the Samudra Beach Hotel where we're staying has a room, room 308, that no one is allowed to reserve because it's permanently set aside for the Queen of the Southern Ocean, a kind of sea fairy or goddess who rules over a submerged city and occasionally appears on land to interact with mortal humans. Obviously, I'm interested in submerged cities, particularly submerged cities around the islands of Indonesia, which were all part of a giant continent known to geologists as Sunda Land that was above water and connected to the rest of Southeast Asia until about 11,600 years ago. When sea levels rose cataclysmically at the end of the Younger Dryas, this region lost more habitable land, including a massive low-lying plain, than almost anywhere else on Earth. Although it's close to midnight, I therefore insist on paying a visit to room 308, which is fully decorated and furnished as a royal boudoir, complete with imaginative paintings of Najai Lara Kidul, the Queen of the Southern Ocean. It's a romantic story, and who knows, there may be something to it. Certainly no attempt to uncover the mysterious origins of human civilization can afford to ignore the rapid drowning of Sunda Land, which was fertile and well-watered with four major river systems before it was flooded. Indeed, it's because of this, and because much of the flooding occurred around 11,600 years ago, precisely the date that Plato gives for the submergence of Atlantis, that our travelling companion, geologist Dani Natwijaja, believes Indonesia is Atlantis and has made such efforts to investigate the extraordinary megalithic pyramid of Gunung Padang. Gunung Padang, which I first visited in December 2013 and described in Chapter 2, is 120 kilometres north of us, and we'll be going back there at the end of this trip. Before we do, however, there's one more site we want to see. It's called Tugugede, near the village of Chengkuk, 20 kilometres into the mountains north of Pelabuhan Ratu. We set off in the morning, on another of those precipitous and slightly alarming roads that Indonesia has so many of, but once again, the trip is worth it. We go as far as the car can take us and then have a long walk, first through a village in the midst of banana plantations, and then into quite dense forest, coming eventually to a mystic glade, where a massive central menhir, shaped at its sides, coming to a point like an obelisk, juts 3 meters straight up out of the earth. It is surrounded by a ring of smaller menhirs, some fallen, some still standing, and round about there are huge numbers of further worked stones, many with patterns of cupules carved into them very similar to the cupules at Karahantepe in Turkey. Tugugede has been the subject of some cursory excavations, but there appears to be no clear consensus on its antiquity. The megaliths themselves are accepted as prehistoric, thousands of years old, although exactly how many thousands no one seems to know. But there are also later occupation layers that have yielded up pottery and artifacts that are only a few hundred years old. And of course the site stands close to, and is impacted by, human settlements to this day. One of the most anomalous finds is a small statue. On no very good grounds, archaeologists suppose it to be a representation of the Hindu god Shiva, but it bears no resemblance to any images of Shiva that I've seen, and to my eye at least, looks much more like a crudely worked ancient Egyptian figure with its crossed hands and distinctive headdress. Mainstream archaeology does not believe that the ancient Egyptians could have reached Indonesia, so this possibility has never been considered. However, there is compelling evidence that long-distance oceanic voyages were undertaken from Egypt during pharaonic times. For example, the presence in 9 mummies dated between 1070 BC and AD 395 of cocaine and tobacco, both indigenous American plants not previously thought to have been present in the Old World before the time of Columbus. These findings by S. Balabanova, F. Parsh, and W. Persig have been disputed by other scholars who regard long-distance ancient Egyptian sea voyages as a priori impossible. According to Egyptologist John Baines, for example, the idea that the Egyptians should have travelled to America is overall absurd. And I also don't know anyone who spends time doing research in these areas because they're not perceived to be areas that have any real meaning for the subject. The way I see it, however, this comment by Baines is more indicative of a deep-seated problem within Egyptology itself and within archaeology in general than of a problem in the factual findings of Balabanova et al. archaeology is too much constrained by a rigid reference frame of what is possible and what is not, and tends to ignore, sidestep, or ridicule evidence that challenges that reference frame. This is equally true when it comes to the case for a lost civilization of the Ice Age, which again is dismissed on no good grounds other than that it is considered to be a priori impossible. Meanwhile, since the validity of Balabanova's findings has subsequently been vindicated, and therefore we must assume the ancient Egyptians did indeed make voyages as far as the Americas, I see no good reason to ignore the possibility that they also made voyages in the other direction, eastwards towards Indonesia and beyond. Indeed, ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic inscriptions, though once again disputed, have been found at a wilderness site near the town of Gosford, to the north of Sydney in eastern Australia. I have had the opportunity to study these glyphs myself, and do not agree with the mainstream view that they can easily be dismissed as 20th century hoaxes. On the contrary, a recent October 2014 deciphering of the glyphs by hieroglyphics experts Mohammed Ibrahim and Yusuf Abdel Hakim Aiwan concluded, "Not only are the Gosford glyphs legitimate, the scribes accurately used several ancient hieroglyphs and grammatical variations which, crucially, were not even documented in Egyptian hieroglyphic texts until 2012, immediately disproving all long-standing hoax theories. The specific style of hieroglyphs used also provides a linguistic time frame that places an Egyptian presence in Australia at least 2,500 years ago, while the translated text is even so detailed as to identify the ancient scribes by name and occupation." I'm not claiming that the case is settled yet. The Gosford glyphs may or may not be a hoax. Much more work needs to be done to settle the matter. My point, however, is that the use by Orthodox archaeologists of a priori assumptions about what happened in the past as a reason not to conduct wide-ranging investigations into what actually did happen in the past is poor scholarship. In my view, therefore, rather than simply ruling out the possibility that the ancient Egyptians might have reached not only the Americas, but also Indonesia and Australia, we should be asking ourselves why and over what sort of time span they might have made such voyages. In particular, I wonder if it is possible that the tradition of a drowned homeland of the gods somewhere in the East that is so strongly expressed in the Edfu building texts might be connected to this mystery. To be specific, could Indonesia, once part of the mainland of Southeast Asia, and broken up into more than 13,000 islands by cataclysmic sea level rise at the end of the Ice Age, and perhaps particularly Java with its 45 active volcanoes, have been associated in the ancient Egyptian mind with the Isle of Fire, which R.T. Rundle Clark describes as the mystic land of origin beyond the horizon? The very same Isle of Fire, as we saw in Chapter 11, from which Haik, the vital magical essence, was brought by the phoenix to Heliopolis, the symbolic center and navel of the earth. The Isle of Fire, with which Horus of Edfu was directly associated, and where Thoth, the sage, the lord of wisdom, made shrines for the gods and goddesses. The final leg of our 2014 Indonesia journey takes us back to Gunung Padang, the mysterious pyramid for so long thought to be a natural hill that geologist Dani Natwijaja, through determined efforts, has brought to the attention of the world. I won't describe it again since I've already introduced it to the reader in Chapter 2. We've seen how the megalithic site of columnar basalt, visible on the uppermost terraces of Gunung Padang, is simply the latest episode in its long story, and how Danny and his team used seismic tomography, ground-penetrating radar, and other remote sensing technologies to show that the man-made structures go down tens of meters beneath the surface. Core drilling into these buried structures was undertaken, producing organic materials with impeccable provenance that yielded ever more ancient carbon dates extending back ultimately to more than 22,000 years ago, before the end of the last ice age, when our ancestors are supposed, according to the orthodox archaeological model, to have been nothing more than primitive hunter-gatherers, incapable of large-scale construction and engineering feats. Intriguingly, as I also reported in Chapter 2, the remote sensing equipment flagged up the presence deep within the pyramid of what appeared to be three hidden chambers, so rectilinear in form that they're most unlikely to be natural. The largest of these lies at a depth of between 21.3 and 27.4 meters, 70 to 90 feet, and measures approximately 5.5 meters, 18 feet high, 13.7 meters, 45 feet long, and 9.1 meters, 30 feet wide. On our visit to Gunung Padang in early June 2014, excavations were still being held up by objections from archaeologists, but by August, following a decisive intervention by Indonesia's then President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, Danny and his team were finally able to proceed for a first short season. Unfortunately, however, the work was halted very soon afterwards in October 2014, when President Yudhoyono completed his second term of office and stepped down. His successor, President Joko Widodo, has thus far not shown the same level of interest in and enthusiasm for the project, perhaps because of objections from Bandung Archaeological Center Chief Desriel Shanti, who launched a public attack on the Gunung Padang excavations in late September 2014, complaining that they did not follow the standard methods that are usually applied to archaeological projects. "I've yet to go to the site," she said, "but I can judge it from photographs. An archaeological excavation method shouldn't be carried out in that way." She also objected that funding had been allocated to the work. This funding, she felt, should have gone to her own department. At the beginning of October 2014, as the reader will recall from Chapter 2, Danny had written to me enthusiastically as follows. "The research progress has been great. We have excavated three more spots right on top of the megalithic site in the past couple of weeks, which give more evidence and details about the buried structures. We have uncovered lots more stone artifacts from the excavations. The existence of the pyramid-like structure beneath the megalithic site is now loud and clear. Even for non-specialists, it is not too difficult to understand if they come and see for themselves. We have found some kind of open hall, buried by soil 5 to 7 meters thick. However, we have not yet got into the main chamber. We are now drilling to the suspected location of the chamber, based on subsurface geophysics, in the middle of the megalithic site." It was only a few days after Danny sent me that mail that the presidency changed hands, and the drilling and excavations were stopped. Nonetheless, the first short, interrupted season did produce important results. As Danny confirmed in his correspondence with me, even the relatively young lair that was all they had time to excavate, the second artificial columnar rock lair beneath the megalithic site visible on the surface, yielded a radiocarbon date of 5,200 BC, in other words, 7,200 years ago, nearly 3,000 years older than the orthodox dating for the pyramids of Giza in Egypt, and there are firm indications from the original remote sensing and core drilling work of much older layers below. In short, it is now evident to all that Gunung Padang is vastly older than the 3,000 years that archaeologists had insisted upon for decades. Even the most hostile amongst them, therefore, have begun to reframe their assessment of the site and to refer to it as a gigantic terraced tomb, which was part of the biggest megalithic culture in the archipelago. I stayed in touch with Danny during the writing of this book. On the 14th of January 2015, he emailed me to tell me the disappointing news that further fieldwork had not yet been authorized. "We are still waiting for the new government to take action on the continuity of the national team for Gunung Padang," he wrote. He was concerned, he added, about construction activities that had been undertaken at Gunung Padang in the interim by Public Works, Tourism Department and others. "They are conducted without a clear plan, design and consultation with us, so they are destroying the site." He remained optimistic, however, that he and his team would be allowed to continue with their excavations shortly. "If so," he said, "by the end of 2015, I hope to know more about the second layer, the 7,000 years old constructions, and begin to understand about the third layer, pre-10,000 years ago." On the 10th of March 2015, I heard from Danny again. Most unfortunately, he could only report that there had been no progress at all since his mail of the 14th of January. The new Ministry of Culture has not activated the national team yet. We are still waiting and hoping the new ministry will have a good attitude toward Gunung Padang research. Time will tell, but the auspices do not look good, and as Magicians of the Gods goes to press, I fear that the dead hand of Orthodox archaeology may once again have prevailed, in what almost appears to be a deliberate strategy to prevent us from learning the truth about our past. Below the layers, dated to approximately 7,000 and 10,000 years ago, are the even older strata of man-made constructions at Gunung Padang. These strata, as yet unexcavated, as yet unexplored, identify